Welcome to KSKA's A Closer Look. I'm Len Anderson. This edition of A Closer Look examines the state of Alaska's Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, located in Anchorage. Actually, we're looking at two state crime labs. There's the new two-story V-shaped $87.5 million structure on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Avenue, scheduled for a June 2012 completion, and the current one, a squat, single-story building located next to the Alaska State Trooper headquarters on Tudor Road. Compared to its successor about six blocks away, a charitable description of the current lab facility might be compact, or as forensic laboratory manager Orrin Dim says, compressed.
We're a critical function where, you know, we have been, unfortunately, the hairball clogging the pipes of justice. It's not a pretty analogy, but it's pretty accurate. You have investigators in the field who are doing their job. We have a Department of Law who's doing their job, and things are getting stuck here at the crime lab because we haven't had the throughput to be able to handle it. Now we're getting better, and we're getting more efficient, and we're bringing in robotics. And the last phase of that improvement is getting that facility up online where we can decompress and have a more efficient operation and have the ability to handle what's coming next.
When the current lab opened in 1986, it housed the Alaska State Troopers Crime Laboratory and the State Medical Examiner's Office and Lab. The combined staff numbered 8. The building's maximum efficient capacity is 20. That number was passed some time ago. The facility, now the Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, and serving police departments across the state as well as the troopers, houses a staff of 40. The medical examiner has moved elsewhere. A visit to the current lab reveals almost no room serving its original function and only a few administrative offices large enough for their assigned occupants. Dim says despite the overcrowding and severe space shortage, the reliability of the work done is never compromised. Other elements, however, are.
We talk about the cramped quarters. The question becomes, what about the quality? And this is why you keep hearing me talk about efficiency gains when we move to this laboratory. Rule one is the work has to be done to a certain quality level. So in order to accommodate that in an overcrowded facility, what happens is you lose efficiency. In other words, less work gets done because you have to do things like no more than two people can be in this lab at a time. This work can only be done under these situations. So because of the overcrowding, you have business rules set up that lower efficiency because you cannot lower the quality. When you come to this facility, those business rules no longer have to be in place, so you gain efficiency with the same quality.
The quality of the laboratory's forensic work shows, for example, in the arrests in two high-profile, long-standing, separate cold-case murders, Bonnie Craig and Genevieve Tetpon, along with the arrest of Josh Wade for the killing of Mindy Schloss. And just a couple of weeks ago, Alaska State Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters announced one more example of that efficiency. This time, it was the conclusion of a 1991 sexual assault case involving a then 8-year-old Wasilla girl.
We recently had an old abduction rape case come to a conclusion. The case was essentially closed by what we call exception. The suspect in the case is deceased, but there's been a DNA match that ties him to this case, and they've been able to go back and look into the history of it along with the DNA connection and decided that after this evidence has come about, the case is closed.
I was a commander out in Valley when that case occurred and watched that whole investigation go on and was intimately familiar with it.
John Glass is a retired Alaska State Trooper.
The satisfaction that I got seeing that the crime lab had found out who had done that case, I immediately called the initial investigator who did most of the work on that case, who has since retired and is living in the Auburn, Washington area. And I mean, I made his day when I could tell him that the crime lab had solved his case of 20 years ago. I mean, that kind of stuff is, you can't really know how a person feels until you've been part of that system.
Besides his trooper career, beginning in 2007, Glass also served 2.5 years as deputy commissioner for the Alaska Department of Public Safety. It was then that Glass's relationship to the state crime laboratory changed from that of a trooper sending evidence to the lab. As deputy commissioner, he was tasked with promoting the construction of a new facility to the legislature.
New lab's been on the talking stages for years, but when I came back to public safety as a deputy commissioner in 2007, that was part of my job, was to try and obtain the crime lab. So the next 2.5 years I was a deputy commissioner, that's primarily what I was doing, was trying to get the funding to build something like this.
What's it like seeing the staff?
The excitement on their faces and what they've had to work in over the years, and when they get here, it'll be just really gratifying, very gratifying. It's worth all the pain and agony that went into it.
Although Glass is no longer a deputy commissioner, laboratory manager Dim had invited Glass to come along on an initial tour of the semi-completed new facility with about 10 crime lab staff. The group were members of the chemistry section. Cabinets and basic workstations had just been installed in their future labs. You're listening, by the way, to KSKA's A Closer Look, where we delve into issues and events beyond our normal news stories. Today's topic, the new $87.5 million State of Alaska Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, currently under construction in Anchorage. The agony aspect former Deputy Commissioner Glass mentioned rose in part from arguments voiced by the Alaska Policy Forum against the proposed crime lab expansion project. The forum's talking points reappeared on conservative AM radio talk shows, letters to the editor, and news stories. On its website, the Alaska Public Forum describes itself as a nonprofit think tank that supports free market ideals and open government. Its board members and finances are not given. In March 2010, the forum issued a policy brief based upon its larger 35-page study, attacking what they termed the fiscal irresponsibility of the crime lab expansion. The brief charged the lab would be one of the most expensive crime laboratories ever constructed in the country. It compared unfavorably the costs with other lab projects in Iowa, Phoenix, and for the FBI. And the forum declared the Alaska lab was experiencing a reduced or flat demand for its various services. Altogether, right down to the shrubbery and trees, picnic area, and front staircase, the forum's fact sheet found 25 points against the expansion. It listed no fact in favor. Governor Sean Parnell had earlier introduced the construction funding bill, and during the 2010 session, the state legislature approved it. Construction began a month after approval. If critics of the project found nothing positive, the staff and the former deputy commissioner on that recent construction site tour did. Their delight in the physical and procedural changes began as soon as laboratory manager Dim guided them through a large door in the back of the building and then into a succession of rooms.
So a unique feature on this lab is the evidence sally port, and it's probably unique to any crime lab in the country, but one of the weakest points of evidence transfer when it comes in is, and especially in the wintertime, you pull up with a van full of evidence, and then you open and close the door to the lab about 100 times as you carry the evidence in and out through the slippery snow and ice. So what we've done here is actually created a sally port where the vehicle can pull in, the garage doors come down, and now you have a secure transfer of all that evidence, and I think the energy benefit of not opening and closing that door to the lab 100 times in the middle of winter. We have our chemical storage is over here, but then we have our gas cylinder storage and our bio waste storage. And if you look, there's a doorway here. So what it's set up to ensure the integrity of the lab and the seal for evidence is this corridor is actually space that people can come into. We have to buzz them in, so it's not open space, but it is unrestricted in that a vendor can come in because breath alcohol has its own security seal, evidence has its own security seal. So a vendor can access cylinder storage and biological hazard storage and service those areas without the laboratory having to put someone out of service to assist. So that's why this door is here and these facilities are over there. So this is actually, you guys will appreciate this room here. We actually have an evidence viewing room now. So one of the problems we've had is a lot of times, especially since we retain biological evidence, attorneys want to come and view evidence, and we really have no facility for that. So a lot of times you're viewing evidence in a classroom or really non-laboratory space. So we have this nice secure evidence viewing room right off of evidence so we can take care of that need. We have about 500 square feet of evidence space in the current laboratory. Here we have about 5,000 square feet of evidence storage. And again, when you think about having to store sexual assault kits for 50 years for the entire state, and you've seen the size of the new kits, that starts to make sense. This is our biological screening laboratory. Right now we have two people with a floor microscope, a couple of small benches. So we're looking at being able to have larger benches, more mobile boom scopes to be able to get over the evidence. And then we have two alternate light source rooms now so that more than one person can actually light up evidence at a time and look for stains. For our biological science section is we put a reagent prep lab between the bioscreeners and the DNA group so they can share reagent prep. And so it's centrally located to both of them. And then we're going to pass into our DNA laboratory. When we pass into the DNA lab, now this is a door that does open between them. We've got the lab space for extraction of samples. There's PCR set up, and then there's the amplification laboratory all separated out. The other thing is, I hope you've been noticing as we went in and out of the labs, the vestibules into and out of a place where you can come in, put on your lab coat, put on gloves, put on eye protection, enter a laboratory space, de-glove, de-lab coat on your way out, and that should help to eliminate or reduce dramatically cross-contamination as we bring things in and out, whereas now you go from the carpeted hallway directly into the lab. Here we actually have a transition zone to bring those contaminants down. The size of these steel beams. So let's talk about a science where you're looking at maybe bullets or cartridges under high magnification. You're looking at sperm under a microscope. If a building shakes, it makes it very difficult to do that work. So one of the designs in this building is you have to be able to do microscopic work under high magnification. One of the problems we had at the existing lab when they put in the new MLK road, as they were vibropacting, we actually couldn't do work under the microscope during that time because the images were vibrating too much. So take a look at the size of these steel beams. This building, and Matt Tanaka probably has the better explanation of the engineering than I can give you, Matt.
Yeah, actually, the way we designed the building was to put in what's called a moment frame, which means you put in really thick columns, really thick beams, and then you attach them together, the columns to beams, with a really rigid connection. That's what gives you rigidity. And also means that you don't have to put in a lot of intermediate columns and bracing on side bracing to keep it standing. So what you end up with is more open spaces in the lab that you can more easily renovate in the future if you need to. So we gave a lot of thought into what sort of a structure we put in place to keep this lab rigid.
Matt Tanaka is the Department of Transportation's project manager at the site. DOT oversees new state facility construction. You're listening to A Closer Look, focusing today on Alaska's Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, scheduled for occupancy next June. The 84,200-square-foot facility will replace the 1986-built lab in its slightly more than 19,000 square feet. During the tour, Dim commented on the new building's quadrupled floor space, as well as cooking dope and the firearms library.
Really, what you have are nine laboratories stuffed into this building. So when you do pass by it on the outside, people look and say, well, that's a big building. It's a big building, but when you think about putting nine laboratories inside that building, each laboratory itself is appropriately sized. The analogy we walked in, he said each room just is an expanded version of what you saw in the old laboratory. Exactly. We're decompressing. You know, we're about twice as many people as should be in that facility. So when you walk into these rooms, you see that instant expansion of space, which will be adequately filled the day we move in.
What's the capacity, do you think, for personnel now?
Well, this facility is designed to be able to hold with it. Now, keep in mind, there's 17,000 square feet of shell space. With the shell space built out, this building is designed to hold 65 analysts before it enters what they call the compression phase. Compressing like we are at our current laboratory, we figure we can actually squeeze 80 to 90 in the facility, but that's not a permanent thing. That's as you expand if it's needed. But the idea here was we started as a trooper lab. They outgrew that, so they built the crime lab we're in now. We outgrew that, so we're building this crime laboratory. The goal was to quit building crime laboratories and quit moving and build a facility that could serve the state for the long term, because the crime lab is a long-term function for the state. There's 84,000 gross square feet. 20,000 square feet of that is mechanical support space, non-laboratory space, to ensure that air moves in this building properly, that there's heat in the building. You have 5,000 square feet that's simply evidence storage space. And again, we had the biological evidence retention law passed two sessions ago, where we are looking at, for at least 50 years, retaining biological evidence. That's why it's 5,000 square feet. And then you have the physical laboratories. You have a firearms laboratory. Now that's firearms and tool mark. You have biological screening. You have DNA. DNA is comprised of DNA casework for major crimes, DNA property crimes, and our DNA database section. You've got our latent print laboratory. You have blood alcohol. You have support for statewide breath alcohol. You have drug chemistry. So there's a lot of activities that go on inside this laboratory.
So,
you know, think about how many times we actually can't get into our own classroom to train, or when we do, say, the breath alcohol schools, we have to limit our classroom size. We have two 30-person classrooms that open up to a single 60-person classroom, so we should finally be able to meet the training needs of the state.
And you train people from other departments?
Statewide law enforcement, all agencies. We've done drug identification classes, field testing classes. We do breath alcohol training. We assist and host through other training organizations. We've had photography of shoe and tire impressions, collection of physical evidence. So there's a very large training schedule that we're involved in. One of the more interesting things that happened in the legislature as we were trying to get this building, as we were talking about this training function, one of the questions from the legislature was, well, why don't you just use the university's facilities? Because we are just down the street. And I replied, well, they don't like it when we bring a kilo brick of cocaine on campus and make crack. And we did get some interesting looks, and I explained, if officers are going to go out in the field and say this looked like it was a crack house, that they were making cocaine base, we provide the training to those officers to have the experience and the knowledge to say, that's why I thought this was going on, rather than they were making spaghetti or a piece of Vision's cookware on the counter. And part of that is we sit down and we actually go through the process with them. So right now, our latent print lab, probably the biggest issue I see with it is just poor ventilation. They're working drug evidence. There's very little ventilation. So here you see a lot of large open space. There'll be fume hoods, ventilated hoods in the middle. You have good room ventilation to keep them safe and secure. We'll have little benchtop superglue cabinets for quick access and quick work on supergluing. We have two alternate light source rooms where they can light up evidence with the laser. Should provide a lot of improvement in workflow.
This is a great deal more space.
Exactly. Well, a couple of things you pick up here. You notice the venting on the water tank. You saw the water tank we had there. There's no venting when they're test firing into the tank to carry away the fumes from shooting. Lead exposure is obviously a big issue for firearms examiners. You're talking about someone firing about 1,000 rounds of ammunition a year indoors. So we pick up the ventilation. We pick up a bigger water tank than what we have. We pick up separate storage for ammunition, so it's not in the range where they're shooting. And then the range itself is a little bit wider, although it is a little shorter. And we have this large opening on the range now, so we can do ejection pattern testing. Because sometimes the question isn't about the bullet or the gun, it's about the pattern of bullet of cartridges found on the ground. So you're going to be shooting looking at how the gun gets rid of cartridges and what's the pattern.
This water tank won't leak?
It's not supposed to, and it is warrantied. It's not like our old water tank, which was found in the bushes outside of an old lab and, while free, has been patched a few times and is still leaking and froze over once. And then this would be the area where we have the stereo microscope set up for each analyst. So this would be the area where they do the physical comparison once they've generated the exemplars to compare. You saw the closet where we have all our weapons stored, and we're capped at about 1,200 capacity. This room will enable a capacity of about 10,000 weapons, high-density shelving, so we can go back to building that reference collection, because, as we talked about in the lab, everything's about comparison to a standard. when that question comes in, is the safety operating right on this weapon? Is this the way the weapon's supposed to operate? Without some representative sample to go back to, that can be a very difficult question to answer, and it can be a very critical question. So we try to, as weapons are being disposed of, if we don't have one in our collection, the idea is to try and get one into the collection so you have a reference sample. And 10,000 is about what he feels he needs to have a sufficient collection to do the job. High school students, college students, people who are interested in forensics, we are the state crime lab. We do serve the state. And one of our roles is to try and help and educate our school students. So we do quite a few tours with them. And the weapons collection really is quite a fascinating collection. So to try and keep from having to break the integrity of the seal of the lab, we did put a display window here on the other side of the weapons storage room so that when we give tours, we can show them what a reference collection is, why we have it, without having to actually break the security of the laboratory.
Earlier, I'd asked Dim about the crime lab's caseload. He responded to comments that Alaska crimes were down and the caseload of the crime laboratory had lessened. Thus, the new lab is an unnecessary luxury.
There are a number of issues wrapped into that. It's actually a pretty complex issue. One question, something that's concerned me since I've come to the state and to this laboratory, is the unsubmitted workload. What you find is because the laboratory for years had been behind in work, your agency started triaging the work they sent to the lab. I have a crime that's been committed, and I'm looking at it going, well, am I going to send it to the lab? Well, what we see agencies doing is going, wow, you know, if I send this, the five homicides I have there might not get worked. So they're triaging what they send to the lab. So one, you're trying to gauge what is the unmet backlog, what's the unsubmitted backlog that folks are waiting to submit because they don't want to backlog their what they deem more important cases. So you have that component out there. And the question becomes, well, how do you know that occurs? We know it occurs because I've talked to police chiefs of organizations and investigators, and they've said this is what's occurring. The other is you'll see a case come in from 2 years ago. And you go, well, where's this case been for 2 years? This is a sexual assault. Why am I just seeing it now? Well, you know, we had other more important cases. We didn't want to back up the crime lab, but it's important now, so we need it worked. Well, that's an unacceptable situation. That's not how a forensics center should be working in a state and providing service to the state. The other thing you see is every advancement in technology, and DNA is a prime example. When this building was opened, the analysis we do today didn't exist. We were doing blood typing. Then they did what's called polymarker DQ-alpha, and then we went to STRs. And every new technology that came out, the question became, okay, the cases from 10 years ago, can they benefit from this new technology? So now you're not only doing today's cases, you're going back and redoing cases over the last 20 years because they're applicable to the new technology. You're putting them in the database and you're getting hits and you're solving crimes that you couldn't solve before. Let's look at the cold case investigations where they're going back, looking at crimes, going, what can we bring new technology to today that didn't exist before? So those cases are coming in, and that's new casework. We have the new laws that get passed. A prime example, and it's a very successful example. I always like to use this one because it's when you take planning with purpose, with funding, you can have success. Our DNA database program, when it was expanded to arrestees, that bill provided staff, it provided funding to work the samples. Now, it didn't provide space that we had to make room for, but we took an 18,000 sample backlog and eliminated it. And today, our database samples are all worked within 30 days. And that's about 500 samples a month coming in. And these are from those arrested individuals or convicted felons that have to provide a sample going into the database, and those then provide leads to real crimes that are being solved. And let's talk about how that branches out. So we get a hit in the database. Guess what? We just got a new case to work. Because when we get a hit in the database, the first thing that happens is we go and get a new sample from the individual, the suspect, except this time with the search warrant, so that it's a criminal case sample. And you rework it to confirm the hit. then you now have a case that's going, and with that you now have court time in our cases, and that's increased. So while there's been technology, while some things have gone down in price, other things haven't. Let's look, and again, I'll keep talking DNA because it's really at the forefront of new changes. STR analysis has been around. We've got the database. It's working great. Up comes what we call YSTR analysis. Well, this is a technique that looks at just male DNA. So if we look at a crime where you have a female victim and a male, and let's say we have a contact situation, a push, a shove, a bite, or lick, when you swab that sample, you've got a sea of female DNA with a small amount of male DNA, depending on the type of contact. It can be very difficult to find. With YSTRs, we can blank out the female DNA. So we're just looking at the male portion. Tremendous technique. Again, the next question is, what cases over the last 20 years have I had where this might be useful? So in addition to the cases I'm going to work today moving forward, we're now going to go back looking through cases. One of the things we do in our DNA arena now is when a case comes in where we think there's hope for future technology to work on this case, we flag it. So we can actually go back in the database now and take a look at these, because you have to have some way of finding them rather than hand sifting through every case. These techniques have not gotten any cheaper. You know, the 310 genetic analyzer we used to use in DNA was replaced by the 3100, has been replaced by the 3500. They've gotten faster, higher capacity. They haven't gotten any cheaper, though. They've actually gone up in price because they do more, and they do it faster, and they're more sensitive.
Finally, Crime Lab Manager Dim spoke to suggestions that the new facility cost could have been avoided by simply going to a 24-hour daily schedule.
One city crime laboratory I know of, the problem was so severe, they did go 24 hours operation in their DNA laboratory, and the tech manager put a stop to it, had them lease a facility temporarily while a new lab was being built, to go back to just single shifts because the background levels of DNA were going up so high it was interfering with their abilities to make calls and cases. Now, ultimately, we serve the people of Alaska, victims and suspects, the judicial system. If you were the victim of a crime and I had to tell you, I'm sorry, but, you know, we put the building into 24-hour service. Yeah, we knew there'd be a lot of background DNA. Your case was a marginal sample and we weren't able to make an identification. You're not going to be very happy about that decision. Again, what are we here to do? We're providing a service to the citizens of Alaska. What's their expectation of us? Their expectation is nothing short of the best and most excellent forensic science on a sample they can get. Whether you're being charged with a crime, your expectation is it's going to be solid and locked tight. Or if you're the victim of a crime, you don't want to see the wrong person charged. So that is ultimately our responsibility, and the question becomes, what's the best mechanism to carry that out? You can push a space into use in overdrive, but it's going to have an impact. It's going to impact the quality of the science you put out. The trade-off on there is very real effects to the people you serve.
Orrin Dim, Forensic Laboratory Manager. The 40-member staff of Alaska's Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory will begin serving the citizens of the state from the new facility in June 2012. This has been A Closer Look, a production of KSKA-FM Anchorage. I'm Len Anderson. Thanks for listening.